Are you really buying a car online on AutoTrader right now?
Really? I can get super specific with dealer listings and see cars based on my budget.
Mom!
You can really have it delivered.
Or pick it up.
Mommy, look!
I think your kid is walking up the slide.
Really? AutoTrader. Buy your car online. Really?
Hello and welcome to episode 232 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rotta, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Citizenship is one of those words we hear constantly in politics, in debates about immigration, in discussions about rights and responsibilities, but it's surprisingly slippery to define. Sometimes we talk about citizenship as a legal status, sometimes granted by a government, documented by papers, and protected by law. Other times we talk about it as an ideal, a set of values, behaviors, and obligations that describes what it means to belong to a community. And right now, those two meanings seem to be pulling apart. Rick, today I want to talk about citizenship, what it means legally, what it means morally, and why it has become such a contested idea. Do you think citizenship is something you have, something you practice, or something you aspire to?
Well, this is one of the things that makes the very idea of citizenship difficulty is that it's all three. You either are or are not a citizen legally. It's something you can attain in various ways. It's also something we practice. We practice citizenship when we're voting, but I think we also practice it when we just keep informed about what's going on with our government, when we attend local meetings of the city council, for example. I think it's also an ideal that we can aspire to. Like we can talk about practicing citizenship as a virtue.
It like you said, it can be kind of complicated. And you know, so much of this by some people look at citizenship as sort of a binary choice. Either you are or you're not. And the path to citizenship, at least in our current system, I'm talking legally right now, is difficult, is confusing, is complicated. And it seems like that's sort of by design, right?
I mean, it is complicated. I don't know if it is by design. I think it's complicated just because the world is complicated now with the amount that people travel. I mean, people are more mobile than they've ever been.
Absolutely.
And so that makes the very idea of citizenship kind of problematic if we're talking about something like birthright citizenship, where people are moving around, where you might have parents who are U.S. citizens or one parent who's a citizen, but you're born in another country and then move to another country yet again when you're like 3 or 4 years old. This is not uncommon in the world today.
And one of the worst things I'll tell you about doing a show like this is sitting here and coming up with a question that you wish you would have looked at before you sit down to talk about it. But as we're discussing this, we have a system in our country where if you want to become a citizen, there's many things you have to do. But one of those important things is there's a test. I mean, it's actually, and there, we'll talk about how that may be changing a little bit. But like what I'm unclear about, and I wish I would have looked it up before we sat down today, is that something other countries do, I wonder? And it seems like that's something that we take pretty seriously here. And like, you know, I could become a citizen of Portugal, just to pick a country out of the blue. And Portugal also has a long history of government and has been around a long time. And I don't know if like other countries have such of a test. And maybe you know or maybe you don't, but do you think other countries should?
Yes, certainly. I think there's basic things you ought to know in order to be a citizen. And I don't think it should just be a test that's imposed as part of the naturalization process. We should have basic like citizenship expectations of people who are born here. Like and we used to have a really robust kind of civics education in our public schools. That was regarded as one of the purposes of public education.
For those people who were born here, obviously were born citizens, but also have this this knowledge built up from the beginning about what that means, right?
Yeah. And I think It's very important. It's very important to have a practical knowledge of how government works, for example. What are the three branches of government? What do they do, for example? But it's also important to have some understanding of our story, like who we are, what we aspire to as Americans. And right now we have such widespread disagreement on what it means to be an American that the idea that we have a kind of robust civics education in our public schools, this has become really controversial.
And I would assume it's controversial because so much of that is viewed by some corners of our society as like, well, if you teach it, you're going to obviously infuse the teacher's personal politics into the curriculum, right? Is that it's like in math, that's tougher to do. But I would think that there are some people who would say, gosh, I don't want the public school system teaching my kids civics because, you know, those teachers are usually lefties and they're going to come out of there trying to push some agenda on them. And I just worry that that's why we don't hear more discussion and more promotion of civics education in our public schools is because there's a part of our society that just worries that we're trying to do it for the wrong reasons.
The objection is also, there's some truth to it. Schools of education, universities are overwhelmingly liberal.
The faculty, certainly.
The faculty are, yeah. And then, so the programs reflect that. And so most teachers end up with training that really slants left. And most American studies programs, especially like where our kind of civics curriculum comes from, is quite liberal. In fact, there was a recent survey of something like several years worth of articles in the leading journal on American studies. And they were all either negative about American history or neutral. They couldn't find a single article published that had been positive towards American history. Whatever you think about what American history is, it's not a good thing for our citizens to have a negative view of the country to which they belong. We ought to have a positive view about what we're trying to do and what we're trying to achieve so we have something that we work towards. And so I think many of the right-wing criticisms of civics education have some basis to it. But there's also this widespread view that goes really deep in kind of American sensibility that we are a country that's really focused on individual rights. And so then having any kind of a collective vision is problematic because we just can't agree on what that should be.
A couple of threads I want to pull on there. One, when you're talking about sort of this national outlook on our country, in this year, 2026, of course, is the 250th anniversary of our country's founding. And this is now, we're in February. I think we're going to be hearing a lot more of this as the spring and summer approaches up to July 4th. And it was interesting. I think it'll be interesting to see how that gets framed by different parts of our nation, right? I think there are some people who will look at this as a point of pride. We've had 250, or we will soon be at 250 years of a democracy, and all we've accomplished great things as a country, and we're the most prosperous, most powerful country in the world. In the biggest picture of all, those are great things to be proud of. And then there will also be certain people who will look back at our 250 years and say, oh, but we have to talk about all the things. And there's certainly not a short list of that America's failed on when it comes to things like slavery and how it treats its citizens, how it treats other folks, some of the entanglements, foreign entanglements it's gotten into. So there'll be a lot of those conversations, I think, coming up over the next months about how people look at our country and look at its first 250 years. And I think there will be a lot of people who are skeptical that none of us will be around for the 500th, but a lot of people who will say that there's no way we'll make it to 500.
I have a real problem regarding some of the worst parts of our history as failures. And that's because when you put it in the context of world history, of all the countries in the world, what are the forms of government? How have they operated? What we find is coercion is the dominant means of rule. Even today, only 88 countries in the world have our democracies. 91 are autocracies. So democracy isn't the predominant form of government. It's about 50% of countries. But then when we look at what countries have democracies that are over 100 years old, it's only, I think, 8 or 9, something
and
like that.
Obviously, the United States being one.
Yeah. We're not the oldest, but we're one of the oldest. Yep. We're over 100 years old. 33 countries have democracies that are under 30 years old. So we failed to live up to the ideals that were expressed, say, in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. We have been working consistently towards them. And if you look at the history of governments in the world, we've really been a bright, shining light. I don't regard that as failure. I regard it as like, yeah, we're a work in progress. There's a lot of things that we could do better. But I regard it as a story of achievement. Most stories of achievement, you look at anybody who obtained some great goal in their life, they didn't achieve it at the beginning and then maintain it. They worked gradually towards it. That's a story of our country. That's not a story of failure. That's a story of incremental progress.
One story of our country right now certainly is how we're tackling this immigration issue. And some of that is the path to citizenship. There's other parts of that as well. And I think there would be a lot of people, some people listening right now, who say that we should restrict the number of people who become citizens, and even restrict immigration for the very fact that we need to protect our national identity, and that if we greatly increase the number of people who are coming here from foreign lands, that we greatly increase the number of people who can become citizens here, it just changes our country into a place that we no longer recognize. I'm sure that's not a philosophy with which I agree, but that's certainly a real and meaningful talking point for a lot of people in this country, right?
It is a big talking point, and it's I think why we can't have real meaningful immigration reform. So much of the conflict that's going on now in our cities, especially recently in Minneapolis, with the conduct of ICE, is rooted in a long-time failure to have meaningful, systematic immigration reform. Because if we'd had that, I think what we would have democratically run cities and states that are willing to have their law enforcement work with federal officials on immigration enforcement. Right now, we have that unwillingness that then eventually leads to these kinds of conflicts. We have that unwillingness because we can't agree on what the terms of immigration, acceptable immigration, are, because we haven't meaningfully worked on the reform. And it seems like we've just kind of given up on the discussion. And that's a terrible thing for a democracy. So I don't see a way of this conflict being resolved without going back through our legislature and saying, look, we haven't done immigration reform legislatively for a long, long time. We need to do it, because that's the way we have a national conversation, right, about what does it mean to be a citizen? What does our national identity consist in? So now we have two parties that have very different ideas of, say, what it means to be American and what our national identity is, but they are parties that largely don't talk to one another.
And one thing that I know this is a topic you're going to be writing more about this week, and we'll certainly link to that column, but there are some changes being proposed to the citizenship exam, and not surprisingly, those potential changes are politically charged. From what I have read, it sounds like the general thrust of this is to make that test more difficult to pass, right? And I guess you started off here by saying that it's important for people who are coming to our country and who want to become citizens to better understand the country which will be their new home. And as someone who, as a professional, gives tests regularly, do you think these changes proposed to this citizenship exam are appropriate? And do you think it's correct to characterize it as making this a more difficult process?
So here's what the current citizenship exam is. There's 100 possible questions. The candidates get asked orally 10 questions. They have to answer 6 correctly. The new proposal is adding a number of questions. So there'd be 128 questions in the pool. 20 questions are asked, and they have to answer 12 correctly. In both cases, you have to get 60%.
Yeah, true.
You know what we call that in college?
A D minus?
An F.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, in most classes. Yeah.
But that's being hopeful.
That's a passing grade.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So when you say, is the proposed new test going to be too hard? It doesn't seem like it, unless you think the questions themselves are just so hard.
Yeah.
There are some questions that are pretty difficult, but a lot of them are very simple, and they should be the sorts of things that everybody should know, like name the 3 branches of government. I think everybody living in the United States, I mean, if you know how to, like, be somewhat autonomous in your life, you should know how to answer that kind of question. I don't understand the objection that it's too onerous. I think it's one of these things that, again, has become very polarized. The Trump administration had originally implemented this new test in 2020. The Biden administration reversed it, and so now the Trump administration wants to implement it again. And it's one of these things that's become a right-left divide. Here's the thing. It's become a divisive topic without any real substantial discussion of what should we expect citizens to know.
There are plenty of U.S. citizens, people who were born here, people who are adults now, people who live seemingly normal lives, who might struggle to pass some of these tests. And I guess, setting aside the legal status, but if you were born here, I mean, that we can sort of set aside as whether you're here legally or not. But there's plenty of people who are born here legally, and may not pass the good citizenship test, right?
Yes. So, like how many people born here and who know how many U.S. senators there are?
Mm-hmm.
And we know, like, the surveys of, you know, fifth graders, that, like, this isn't widely known. That means it should be taught more purposefully. In my case, like, I went to school at a time where there was a more robust civics education.
Were there 50 states back then, Rick?
There were 50 states.
There were 100 senators, for those scoring at home.
But I think Alaska and Hawaii were recently invented.
Okay.
So, but even then, we were taught things at an early age that were just listed as a number of facts. We'd have multiple tests. Multiple points. What do you call it? Multiple choice. I couldn't even remember what that is.
Yeah,
it's been so long. I don't give that kind of test, and I haven't taken one since I was a kid. Substantial citizenship education should consist of things like Robert's Rules of Order, like how our meetings run.
And that's more at the local level.
Yeah, and I think we should really emphasize, how do you participate in local government? How do you stay informed about what's going on? How do you go to meetings? How do you give voice to your opinions? Like all these things are really important. And, you know, I just had to learn this stuff for myself. And when I ask my college students, for example, how many of them know, like, how to run a meeting, for example, they have no idea, because it's something you have to participate in to do it. In a democracy and we're a representative democracy, so we're a republic, but we have a broadly democratic form of government where all citizens have some input, some say in who represents us. But we also have the opportunity to hold meetings. So something like freedom of assembly, right? Guaranteed in the Bill of Rights. That doesn't mean anything if you don't know how to run a meeting, because that's what an assembly is. So how do you run a meeting? How do you participate in it? We shouldn't be just teaching, like, what are the first 10 amendments? What are the Bill of Rights? Is what do they practically mean, and then practice them? And so I'm in favor of much more robust citizenship training for people, whether they're born in the United States or whether they acquire citizenship, either one, we should have a training process. Or this is how you participate in this form of government.
And just sort of tacking on to that, I probably have mentioned him on this podcast in the past, but one of the teachers who I still remember well was I should remember the year. Let's make sure I get it right. I think it was eighth grade. He was my civics teacher, Mr. Bates, and he did, I think, a great job of instilling this knowledge and for me, at least, and I think others, the interest in this topic. But what he all, and I think at least in Wisconsin at that time and probably almost everywhere, that was like a required course. I mean, you could have opted out of that. So he did a good job. But what he also did, which was an elective, which I think should happen a whole lot more in our schools, and I don't think happens very often, is because, and he was, had lived in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where I grew up most of his life and knew the community well. And he did, I think it was a semester-long elective class about the history of Eau Claire. And sometimes you would just drive around in a school bus, and he would show you, like, here's where this paper mill started, and here's where the courthouse was first built. And that wasn't all show and tell, but that was part of it. But he would talk a lot about just the importance of the place where, well, we were living at that time, and he had called home for many years. And I think that, at least in my experience, is something that is really missing from a lot of our education systems, because, you know, there's no off-the-shelf curriculum for Eau Claire, Wisconsin history. That's something he had to do himself. But I think building those senses of place, especially at the local level, and especially when, like me, you're like 12, 13, 14 years old, is really important. And I think that is part of being a good citizen.
Absolutely. I agree completely. It's one of the ways in which I think our public education has really failed in setting certain standards that are set, it's like at national or state level, that have not paid attention to the importance of knowing one's local community and its history. And for that, you need more autonomy at the local level. And so that's part of what I think, you know, meaningful education reform should be. You know, I'm a big fan of old movies.
I'm afraid you know much more about them than me.
One of the reasons I like old movies is you get a sense of our cultural history. As you look at movies that, you know, like from the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, you get a sense of what life was like and what people's concerns were and so forth. And what we find in the 1940s, especially when we have the build up and then the conduct of World War II, we have a lot of immigrant directors in this country who, in making movies, were also asking this question, what does it mean to be an American? And then you get a number of movies after that, after World War II, that are reflecting back. And one of my favorites is John Ford's movie. He's known mostly for his westerns, The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart movie. There are scenes in the movie where you have Jimmy Stewart teaching reading and writing and U.S. history and the Constitution to a group of school kids. So they're learning their ABCs, but they're also learning to cite the Declaration of Independence. They're saying the Pledge of Allegiance. They're doing these things. And the children are not native speakers. They're immigrants from different countries. And it was so profound. So he's making that movie in 1962 as civil rights is really being contested. I think what happened for a time after World War II is that there was a real knowledge like of how tenuous democracy was. Because democracies all over the world came very close to being completely defeated. If the Axis powers had won, and they came very close to winning that war, it is very likely that there wouldn't be any democracies in the world today, that there would be all autocratic rule of one form or another. And I think, you know, somebody like John Ford, who participated in D-Day as a filmmaker, you know, he was part of documenting this war and witnessed how tenuous some of these decisive victories were. I thought he felt as an obligation to educate us as Americans of what does it mean to be an American? What are the requirements? There are scenes in there of people running meetings, voting for statehood. You know, like, how do we get established as a country? We don't have that anymore. We don't have it as part of our cultural kind of memes that are going on. Where culturally do we reflect on who we are? I don't see it going on. And what I notice is there's just a lack of sufficient appreciation for how significant our form of government is and what it takes to maintain it.
I think a lot of what you say is true, but I wonder if that feeling is much less seen in the people who have just gone through what we've already said is a long and complicated process of becoming a citizen. And right now, that process is stalled for a lot of folks, and I absolutely understand the frustration there. But there are people who are becoming citizens, you know, all the time. And my strong sense is that the people who cross that finish line have, or probably in most cases have, a much greater appreciation for our country, its ideals, and for now their place in it. And I guess I'd be curious, one, if you agree with that, and two, how we can sort of impart that, I guess the word's patriotism, right, on the people who have been here and were born here and will probably live here all their lives, but either take it for granted or at the moment maybe are just dispirited in their country and don't feel patriotic at all and maybe are not proud of being a citizen.
Yeah, I think it's really important to hear the stories of immigrants who've come here and attained citizenship, because you won't find any more patriotic people in the United States. For over 20 years now, at the university where I work, Viterbo University, we've been bringing in Holocaust survivors to tell the story of the Holocaust. But one of the most moving things that nearly all of them talk about is how grateful they are to the United States, both for the rescue, but then providing a haven, providing a place for them to come, become citizens, and raise a family. I mean, this is just really meaningful to them. I talked recently to somebody here from Nicaragua who's in the process of obtaining citizenship, just extraordinarily grateful for the opportunity to live and work in this country. A kind of gratitude that you don't hear expressed from many native citizens.
And certainly, and this is in almost every case driven by political ideology, but there are people who say seriously and sometimes less than seriously that because of the current state of our political leadership, that they want nothing more than to renounce their citizenship. And I'll pick on Portugal again, as I did in the beginning, move to Portugal or move far, far away. And we all know examples of people who, like, it's something to say, but they never do. But there are occasionally people who do that. There is a way to voluntarily renounce your citizenship. Is this something? I mean, I guess I'm trying to think. I don't think I've ever known anyone who has done that. I don't know if you have, but to me, it just seems like we're sort of, as an American, you're sort of given up. And I suppose that point comes at different times for different people. But my whole take on personally is whether or not I agree with our current government and whether or not I agree with the direction the country's heading at this particular moment, as an American and as all of Americans have the responsibility to kind of right the ship and stay the course, or not stay the course, right the ship and try to readjust the course so we can get where we think we want to be. And I just don't think abandoning ship, to extend the metaphor even further, is probably a great idea, but I don't know what your thoughts are.
I don't understand it at all.
Okay.
I really don't understand why somebody who is an American citizen would want to renounce their citizenship because they disagree with our current government. What do you think, that this is supposed to be easy? I mean, maintaining something like a democracy is a really difficult thing to do and requires work. Now, I can understand somebody who's been heavily invested in politics and suffered a series of defeats and says, okay, I'm just burned out on this. But what I see mostly, the people I've talked to who kind of grumble about going to another country and so forth, are not people who've been heavily engaged. They've been I'd say, passively engage in politics.
Voting,
they vote, they follow things, they post things on social media, and then they express their frustration. But they haven't been heavily involved in, say, their local government. And I keep going back to local. You start with participating in your local communities, and you get really involved, and you grow democratic sensibilities from the ground up. You know, have they been involved in their schools? Have they been volunteering? Have they been doing all these things that help to establish and maintain our democratic norms and sensibilities? And if you haven't been doing that, if you've just been living with the benefits of others who have done that work, and then you want to leave when they start to erode, I mean, well, what the hell? Like, okay, goodbye. Like, we don't need you anyway then. Like, and I'm sorry, I'm getting a little bit angry here, but I think, like, if you're going to be a member of the country, accept that it requires some work to maintain the form of it that you think of as good. And the good is never something that's automatically granted to us. It's always an achievement, because establishing anything that has some kind of order to it is a constant battle against chaos. I mean, things devolve into chaos. That's what they do by nature. And so the fact that you see things devolving into chaos and you say, okay, I'm going to go somewhere else where other people have done all the work of establishing and maintaining the democratic norms that I value, makes no sense to me.
If you're an HVAC technician and a call comes in, Grainger knows that you need a partner that helps you find the right product fast and hassle-free. And you know that when the first problem of the day is a clanking blower motor, there's no need to break a sweat. With Grainger's easy-to-use website and product details, you're confident you'll soon have everything humming right along. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Are you really buying a car online on AutoTrader right now?
Really? I can get super specific with dealer listings and see cars based on my budget.
Mom!
You can really have it delivered.
Or pick it up.
Mommy, look!
I think your kid is walking up the slide.
Really?
AutoTrader. Buy your car online. Really?
This is a message from sponsor Intuit TurboTax. You've sent so many emails to your tax pro and nothing. It feels like you're chasing updates. But now your taxes are done for you by a TurboTax expert, so you actually know what's happening. You can match with an expert and just hand off all your tax stuff to them right in the app. So instead of guessing, you can feel confident your TurboTax expert's on it. Now this is taxes. Intuit TurboTax. Visit TurboTax.com to learn more. Only available with TurboTax experts. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile app.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
This is a message from sponsor Intuit TurboTax. You've sent so many emails to your tax pro and nothing. It feels like you're chasing updates. But now your taxes are done for you by a TurboTax expert, so you actually know what's happening. You can match with an expert and just hand off all your tax stuff to them right in the app. So instead of guessing, you can feel confident your TurboTax expert's on it. Now this is taxes. Intuit TurboTax. Visit TurboTax.com to learn more. Only available with TurboTax experts. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile app.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma, and Rick, I have a question for you. I recently disputed a medical bill that I believed was incorrect. After multiple conversations and a formal review, I was told the charge would not be reduced. I'm unhappy with the outcome, but I've exhausted the official avenues to challenge it. Now we'll go into the hypothetical part of the question. Let's say a few weeks from now, I'm at a social event and I'm introduced to the person who, by chance, handled my case over the phone at this particular healthcare provider and made the final decision about the bill. Do I bring up the interaction with her and express that I still think it was handled poorly, or do I simply let the issue go?
I really don't know. You gave me this question in advance, and I've been thinking about it. And my initial response is, let it go. You're not going to do any good. You're not going to accomplish anything. We're in a time right now where there's the issue of affordability of healthcare and how it is paid for generally is a huge issue for many, many people. And many people are frustrated, especially people who are on the receiving end of healthcare and who end up paying the bills. But if you talk to most people that are in the healthcare business, they're very frustrated with it as well. I've had discussions with a couple doctors recently who are really upset. And one doctor was telling me he has all kinds of issues with paying for his medical care as well. You know, like this. So it isn't as if there's healthcare providers on one side and the general public on the other. It's a system that's just not working very well. And I think there might be opportunities here for having a real healthy discussion with somebody where you're not just complaining to them that you didn't get your bill reduced, but you're actually engaging the person in discussion, like what's going on and how can this be fixed?
Now, in this particular example, this woman I spoke to who was sort of, I didn't get her job title, but I certainly had the impression she was in a decision-making role. And by the time I talked to her, and this was about a week or so ago, we ended up disagreeing, but I wasn't raising my voice at her. I wasn't yelling at her. I should also mention, and this is probably an important part of this, that although this like couple thousand dollar bill is not what I would have wanted it to be, I'm able to pay it. I'll be fine. Right. And part of it was, I just didn't feel that it was the billing process was as transparent as it should be. But the conversation I had with her was really, I think, explored a lot of those issues about how, you know, why aren't you asking questions like, why aren't you more transparent in the process? And, you know, why did I don't want to get into the details in the show here, but like, why did what seemed to me to be a really routine 30-minute clinic visit turn into like a several thousand dollar bill? I mean, that to me, that didn't seem what I expected. But I think I had a lot of those conversations with her over the phone that day. And I think we kind of agreed that I brought up some valid points. We disagreed whether the bill should be reduced, but I felt like we had a healthy and hopefully at least fairly positive interaction. I guess the reason I'm asking this question though is that whether you're a decision-making person in the financial office of a healthcare provider, whether you're a professor at a university, whether you worked for many years as an editor at a local newspaper, those are all jobs which touch on different parts of our community. And I would imagine, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong, but you've worked at your university for a long time. I'm sure when you introduce yourself to somebody new, you're always eager to talk about your department or the good things, the speakers you bring into the community, the good interactions you've had with community leaders over the years. But I'm sure there are people who talk to you about how they are disappointed that your college didn't let their son or daughter admit them, or that they think your tuition isn't quite what it should be, or that maybe a colleague of yours gave a grade that they thought was unfair. I guess, you know, how much of that do you hear when you're talking to the members of the community? Because I know when I worked at a local newspaper, I would often get questions about like, you know, my paper's not delivered on time, or I think your subscription prices aren't what they should be. And like, how much do you as someone who works for an organization have to defend all corners of that organization in social settings? I'm sure that has to have happened to you over the years.
It happens quite frequently because I'm in a fairly publicly visible position. I'm easy to find and reach. And so I'll get people that call me out of the blue or email me or want to talk to me about something going on at the university, sometimes favorably, but oftentimes they have a complaint or a grievance. Usually I'm not in a position to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the thing, when you're in a in a system where there's many different functions, many different decision makers, you might have decision-making capacity within a certain area, but it doesn't mean that you are responsible for establishing rules or policies or systems that produced whatever event people might be upset about. So, for example, one of the things I do have some control over is I bring in speakers. Occasionally, a speaker will do something or say something that somebody doesn't like, or there'll be something in their history that somebody finds objectionable and doesn't think they should be speaking. Usually when I could get a complaint, it's after the fact. Well, I can talk about how I need to pay more attention to that and do something to prevent something like that from happening again. Sometimes there is nothing I could do. Speakers speak, you know, sometimes they say things that I disagree with, and that's just part of the job. And I think in something like healthcare, it's even more complex. So you might have been talking to somebody who has decision-making authorities about resolving certain issues on billing issues. But they didn't establish the procedures for communicating whatever was done and what the billing would be. Now, they might have some input in those meetings. So like by taking your complaint to this person and talking about it very clearly and saying like, this is what I expected and this is what I got. And I think there should be more consistency between what you tell patients and what they get billed. The person probably agrees with that and communicate that to others who are more responsibility for how those expectations get communicated at the very beginning. But this person probably has to make decisions about resolving the billing issue within certain parameters.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are reporting to somebody higher up. And this makes dealing with bureaucracies really frustrating because you want to find, well, where does the buck stop? And it often doesn't stop anywhere.
A couple things I want to get to here. First, like, you know, you say you get calls from people who are, we'll say in this case, upset about something at your university that you don't have direct or even indirect control over. But if that person says to you, oh, Rick, I absolutely understand that, but you've been there a long time, and I bet you know who does have the oversight or the ability to fix this, please, can you please connect me with that person? Will you do that?
Yeah, if I think the person is being reasonable and there's some substance to what they want to talk about,
mm-hmm.
Especially if there's any possibility of like a proactive measures being taken. Oftentimes it's somebody who just wants to vent.
Yeah.
And if somebody just wants to vent, then I'm not going to subject somebody else at the university to that. I'll say like, yeah, just vent to me and that's fine. But I really appreciate it when somebody has a legitimate complaint and wants to talk about it and then ask like, can you help me ensure that this doesn't happen again or doesn't happen to somebody else? And if it's something that I think, yeah, you've got a legitimate complaint here, I agree with you. Let's work on that.
But this is how I'm picturing that exchange happening that we just talked about, is you're sitting at your desk in your university, the phone rings, you pick it up, and you're Rick Kite, Viterbo University employee, having that conversation. Would that conversation be different if you're out with you're at a social situation, there's 20 people in the room, 5 of who you know, 15 who you don't know, and one of those 15 walks up to you and learns you work at Viterbo and then wants to have that conversation when you're not sitting at your desk with the Rick Kite office plate on the front door? Is that different?
Yeah, because there's such a thing as social norms where like there's certain things that are kind of socially acceptable conversation, others that aren't. And it's the sort of thing I'd say, okay, if you really want to talk about this, let's talk about it tomorrow. Or let's make an appointment next week and we can sit down and talk about it. But this is a social event. We're not going to get into it here. Usually something like that, it's not a 5-minute conversation.
Yeah.
It's a half hour.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, and I run into people like this who just have these blinders on. They have this one issue that they're very concerned about, and they think the world should stop while the two of you just take care of this one issue. And they're really offended if you don't agree with, like, taking time and just addressing it right then, because in their eyes, this is so important that it trumps everything else that's going on. But that's a lack of, I would say, social grace or social understanding. You know, you just don't do that to people in social settings.
And how I was picturing it, going back to my specific dilemma, where I'm at a social setting and I'm introduced to this woman who, and I just know her name, I'm not going to talk about it on the show, of course, but like what I would see myself saying to her is, oh, hi, person. It's funny we got a chance to meet in person, because a month ago, you'll probably remember a conversation we had. I was the guy who, you know, the call was escalated to, and we talked about my billing issue around this, this, and that. And I could provide, I think, within two or three sentences, trigger a memory in her that she would know who I am. And again, I want to be clear that it was not like a tremendously confrontational conversation. I had my opinion, she had hers, but we weren't like yelling at each other or calling each other names or anything. And I might even say something like, I said, you know, obviously wasn't the outcome I hoped for, but I want to just stress that I thought you handled that well. And I hope that some of those concerns that I brought up that you said you would discuss as a department actually happened. I mean, if that's the way I frame it, does that seem like okay in a social setting?
Yes, and I think it's one of the really important functions of social interaction is that we get to see a side of people that goes beyond the conflict that we had with them. And so what you do is you acknowledge the point of your connection before was this conflict, but then you also in a way put it aside. And I think it'd be very important to introduce some other things. Like, here's one of the things. When somebody works in a job like that where they're responsible for resolving disputes, what happens is because they're doing that so often, they're seeing a lot of the public as people who are disagreeable and have complaints. And it's very important for them to understand, you know, somebody might call them with complaints, but they're actually a pretty nice person and they have some other things in common. And so they see the humanness, right, in addition to the complaint. In a case like that, I think it's really important to introduce yourself and say something about it.
Well, one last question. I've never really talked about this in the show, but I'm just curious. I'll ask Mr. Ethics if this is the right thing to do or not. But and folks on the show may or may not know, if you've listened for a while, that I spent 20 plus years working in various local newsrooms for Lee Enterprises, the company where this podcast calls home. And for about the last 6 years, I've been a member of the corporate news team where I help with different projects across the company in the news side, but don't work for one particular newspaper or one particular newspaper editor. So, of course, years ago, when I worked for a local newspaper, I would say I work for, you know, insert newspaper here, and people could talk to me about our coverage or our delivery problems or whatever the case may be. And now, since my job is a little less easy to explain, and, you know, not many people know our corporate identity and everything, sometimes, especially if it's somebody who I'm not going to have some long relationship with, they'll just casually mention, hey, what do you do? And I'll just like take the most basic thing and say, oh, I help manage national news websites and I work from home. I mean, that's like the most top level thing I do. But is there anything like wrong with just like sort of being intentionally vague so you don't get into these long, specific, oftentimes complaints about the media or your newspaper delivery or why they didn't cover a particular story the right way? Is it okay to sometimes be so vague that people just sort of don't have an interest in what you do and then move on?
Yes, and I think you have to be the judge of that. I mean, there's certain times where you know if you give a certain description of what you do, mm-hmm. you're going to get the predictable complaints.
Yeah,
and you're kind of tired. You're not going to learn anything new.
Yeah.
You're just going to hear the same things. And yeah, so being vague about it or even misdirecting a little bit, I don't think there's anything wrong with that at times. I don't think it should be a regular practice,
yeah.
but at times where you say, look, I'm really tired today.
Well, and I think I may take the word. I might even just say I help manage a bunch of websites from home. I mean, that's like the most generic thing. I mean, it could be I could work for Amazon. I could work for the U.S. government. I could work for newspaper. I mean, there could be a million different things, right? So In some ways, I guess if people really want to know, they can ask a follow-up. But sometimes that's my starting point.
Yeah, we're talking about social occasions where the conversation oftentimes, like, nothing hinges on what you do. Mm-hmm. They just want to have some kind of idea of who you are.
Yeah.
And that's what you're telling them. Who am I? I mean, in many countries, when you introduce yourself, you tell like what clan or what family you come from, who your relations are, whether you're a father, who your parents are, all this sort of thing. It's relationships. It's not job function. In the United States, we tell people what our job is. There's no reason why we have to do it that way. It's just social convention. And if you want to just change that convention a little bit to be a little bit intentionally vague about it, good for you.
And I'm sure when people meet you for the first time, you say, you know, I host this podcast with this really annoying guy, and he puts up with me for 232 episodes, and I just don't know why he does. That's probably what you tell people.
No, I usually say I teach ethics, which I mean I tell people like you how you ought to live.
The Ethical Life Podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, which may touch on many of the issues we spoke about today, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.
This is a message from sponsor Intuit TurboTax. You've sent so many emails to your tax pro and nothing. It feels like you're chasing updates. But now your taxes are done for you by a TurboTax expert, so you actually know what's happening. You can match with an expert and just hand off all your tax stuff to them right in the app. So instead of guessing, you can feel confident your TurboTax expert's on it. Now this is taxes. Intuit TurboTax. Visit TurboTax.com to learn more. Only available with TurboTax experts. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile app.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes. Intuit TurboTax. See guaranteed details at TurboTax.com/guarantees. Only available with TurboTax experts. Real-time updates only in iOS mobile app.